Chapter 1. When Last Sounds. The wheel of time turns, and ages come and pass, leaving memories that become legend. Legend fades to myth, and even myth is long forgotten when the age that gave it birth comes again. In one age, called the Third Age, by some an age yet to come, an age long past, a wind rose above the broken mountain named Dragon Mount. The wind was not the beginning. There are neither beginnings nor endings to the turning of the wheel of time. But it was a beginning. Born beneath the glow of a fat, sinking moon, at an altitude where men could not breathe, born among writhing currents heated by the fires inside the ragged peak, the wind was a zephyr in the beginning. Yet it gained in strength as it rushed down the steep, rugged slope. Carrying ash and the stench of burning sulfur from the heights, the wind roared across the sudden snowy hills that reared from the plains surrounding the impossible height of Dragon Mount, roared and tossed trees in the night. Eastward out of the hills the wind howled, across a large pasture encampment, a considerable village of tents and wooden walkways lining streets of frozen ruts. Soon enough the ruts would melt, and the last of the snow vanish, replaced by spring rains and mud, if the encampment remained that long. Despite the hour, many among the Aes Sedai were awake, gathered in small groups, warded against eavesdropping, discussing what had transpired this night. No few of those discussions were quite animated, little short of argument, and some held undeniable heat. Fists might have been shaken or worse, had they not belonged to Aes Sedai. What to do next was the question. Every sister knew the news from the riverbank by now, if the details remained sketchy. The Amyrlin herself had gone in secret to seal South Harbor, and her boat had been found overturned and caught in the reeds. Survival in the swift icy currents of the Erinin was unlikely, and hour by hour it had become more so until certainty hardened. The Amyrlin's seat was dead. Every sister in the camp knew that her future and perhaps her life hung by a thread, not to mention the future of the White Tower itself. What to do now? Yet voices fell silent, and heads came up as the fierce blast struck the camp, fluttering tent canvas like flags, pelting it with clods of snow. The sudden stink of burning sulfur hung heavy in the air, announcing where that wind had come from, and more than one Aes Sedai offered a silent prayer against evil. In moments, though, the wind had passed, and the sisters bent back to their deliberations on a future bleak enough to fit the sharp, fading stench left behind. On the wind roared toward Tar Valon, gaining strength as it went, shrieking over military camps near the river where soldiers and camp followers sleeping on the ground suddenly had their blankets stripped off, and those in tents awoke to canvas jerking and sometimes whipping away into the darkness as tent pegs gave way or guy ropes snapped. Laden wagons rocked and toppled, and banners stood out stiff before they were uprooted, their hurtling staffs now spears that pierced whatever lay in their path. Leaning against the gale, men struggled to the horse lines to calm animals that reared and screamed in fear. None knew what the Aes Sedai knew, yet the biting sulphurous smell that filled the chill night air seemed an ill omen, and hardened men offered their prayers aloud as fervently as the beardless boys. Camp followers added their own, and loudly armorers and farriers and fletchers, wives and laundresses and seamstresses, all clutched by the sudden fear that something darker than blackness stalked the night. The fierce flutter of canvas overhead, near to ripping, the babble of voices and the screams of horses, loud enough to cut through the wailing wind, helped Swan Sanchez struggle awake for the second time. The abrupt stink of burning sulfur made her eyes water, and she was grateful for it. Egwene might be able to don and doff sleep like a pair of stockings, but the same was not true for her. Sleep had been hard enough to come by after she finally made herself lie down. Once the news had reached her from the riverbank, she had been sure she never would sleep, short of utter exhaustion. She had offered prayers for Lyanna, but all of their hopes rested on Egwene's shoulders, and all of their hopes seemed gutted and hung up to dry. Well, she had exhausted herself with nerves and worry and pacing. Now there was hope again, and she did not dare let her leaden eyelids close for fear she would sink back into slumber and not wake till midday, if then. The ferocious wind abated, but people's shouts and horses' cries did not. Wearily she tossed aside her blankets and stood up unsteadily. Her bedding was hardly comfortable, laid out on the canvas groundcloth in a corner of the not very large square tent. Yet she had come here, though it meant riding. Of course she had been near falling down by then, and likely not in her right mind from grief. She touched the twisted ring Turangrial hanging from a leather cord around her neck. Her first waking, every bit as hard as this one, had been to fetch that from her belt pouch. Well, the grief was vanquished now, and that was adequate to keep her moving. A sudden yawn made her jaws creak like rusty oarlocks. Barely adequate. You would have thought Egwene's message, the fact that Egwene was alive to send a message, would be enough to banish bone weariness. Not so, it appeared. Channeling a globe of light long enough to see the box lantern on the main tent pole, she lit it with a thread of fire. The single flame gave a very pale, flickering illumination. There were other lamps and lanterns, but Gareth went on so about how little lamp oil there was in stock. The brazier she left unlit. Gareth was not so parsimonious with charcoal as oil. Charcoal was easier come by, but she was barely aware of the frigid air. She frowned at his bedding, still lying untouched on the other side of the tent. He surely was aware of the boat's discovery and who it had carried. The sisters did their best to keep secrets from him, but somehow they succeeded less often than most believed. More than once he had startled her with what he knew. Was he out there in the night organizing his soldiers for whatever the hall decided? Or had he already departed, leaving a lost cause? No longer lost, yet he must be unaware of that. No, she muttered, feeling an odd sense of treachery, that she had cast doubt on the man, even in her own mind. He would still be there at sunrise, and for every sunrise until the hall commanded him to leave, maybe longer. She did not believe he would abandon Egwene, whatever the hall commanded. He was too stubborn, proud. No, it was not that. Gareth Bryn's word was his honor. Once given, he would not take it back unless released, whatever the cost to himself. And maybe, just maybe, he had other reasons to stay. She refused to think of that. Putting Gareth out of her mind, why had she come to his tent? It would have been so much easier to lie down in her own in the sisters' camp, cramped as it was, or even to have kept the weeping chaser company, though on second thought that last might have been beyond her. She could not abide weeping, and Egwene's maid would not stop. Putting Gareth firmly out of her head, she ran a hasty brush through her hair, changed her shift for a fresh one, and dressed as quickly as she could in the dim light. Her plain blue wool riding dress was rumpled and spotted with mud on the hem besides. She had gone down to see the boat for herself, but she did not take the time to clean and press it with the power. She had to hurry. The tent was far from the spacious affair you would have expected of a general, so hurrying meant bumping her hip against a corner of the writing table hard enough that one of the legs almost folded before she could catch it, nearly tripping over the camp stool, the only thing approaching a chair, and barking her shins on the brass-bound chests that lay scattered about. That brought a curse that would have singed any listener's ears. The things served double duty, seats as well as storage, and one with a flat top did for a makeshift washstand with a white pitcher and bowl. In truth, they were arrayed in a neat enough fashion, but one peculiar to him. He could find his way through that maze in pitch dark. Anyone else would break a leg trying to reach his bedding. She supposed he must have a concern for assassins, though he had never voiced it. Gathering her dark cloak from atop one of the chests and folding it over her arm, she paused on the point of snuffing the lantern with a flow of air. For a moment she stared at Gareth's second pair of boots, standing at the foot of his bedding. Channeling another small sphere of light, she moved it close to the boots. As she had thought, freshly blacked. The bloody man insisted she work off her debt, then sneaked in behind her back, or worse, under her nose while she slept, and blacked his own bloody boots. Gareth Bloody Bryn treated her like a maidservant, never so much as tried to kiss her. She jerked upright, her mouth going taut as a mooring rope. Now where had that thought come from? No matter what Egwene claimed, she was not in love with Gareth Bloody Bryn. She was not. She had too much work in front of her to get caught in that kind of foolishness. That's why you stopped wearing embroidery, I suppose, a small voice whispered in the back of her head. All those pretty things stuffed into chests because you're afraid. Afraid? Burn her if she was afraid of him or any man. Carefully channeling earth, fire, and air just so, she laid the weave on the boots. Every last bit of the blacking, and most of the dye as well, came away and formed into a neat, glistening sphere that floated in the air, leaving the leather decidedly gray. For a moment she contemplated depositing the ball among his blankets. That would be a suitable surprise for him when he finally laid down. With a sigh, she pushed open the door flap and took the ball outside into the darkness to let it splash onto the ground. The man had a short and extremely disrespectful way when she let her temper carry her too far, as she had discovered the first time she hit him over the head with the boots she was cleaning, and when he made her so angry she put salt in his tea. Quite a lot of salt, but it had not been her fault he was hurried enough to drain the cup in a gulp. To try to, at any rate. Oh, he never seemed to mind when she shouted, and sometimes he shouted back. Sometimes he just smiled, which was purely infuriating. Yet he had his limits. She could have stopped him with a simple weave of air, of course, but she had her honor as much as he had his, burn him. Anyway, she had to stay close to him. Min said so, and the girl seemed infallible. That was the only reason she had not stuffed a fistful of gold down Gareth Bryn's throat and told him he was paid and be burned. The only reason, besides her own honor, of course. Yawning, she left the dark puddle shining in the cold moonlight. If he stepped in it before it dried and tracked the mess inside, the blame would be his own and none of hers. At least the sulfur smell had faded a little. Her eyes had stopped overflowing, though what she could see was turmoil. This sprawling, night-shrouded camp had never had much order. The rutted streets were straight enough, true, and wide for moving soldiers, but for the rest it had always seemed a haphazard array of tents and rough shelters and stone-lined pits for cook-fires. Now it looked much as if it had been under attack. Collapsed tents lay everywhere, some tossed atop others that still stood, though a good many of those stood askew, and dozens of wagons and carts lay on their sides or upside down. Voices on every side called for help with the injured, of whom there appeared to be a fair number. Men limped along the street in front of Gareth's tent, supported by other men, while several small groups hurried by carrying blankets being used as stretchers. Farther away she could see four blanket-covered shapes on the ground, three attended by kneeling women who rocked back and forth as they keened. She could do nothing for the dead, but she could offer her ability with healing to the others. That was hardly her greatest skill, not very strong at all, though it seemed to have returned to her fully when Nynaeve healed her. Yet she doubted there was another sister anywhere in the camp. They did avoid the soldiers, most of them. Her ability would be better than none. She could, except for the news she carried. It was urgent that it reach the right people as soon as possible. So she closed her ears to the groans and the keens alike, ignored dangling arms and rags clutched to bleeding heads, and hurried to the horse lines on the edge of the camp, where the oddly sweet smell of horse dung was beginning to win over the sulfur. A raw-boned, unshaven fellow with a haggard glare on his dark face tried to rush past her, but she caught his rough coat sleeve. "Saddle me the mildest horse you can find," she told him, "and do it right now." Bella would have done nicely, but she had no notion where among all those animals the stout mare was tied, and no intention of waiting for her to be found. "You want to go riding?" he said incredulously, jerking his sleeve free. "If you own a horse, then saddle it yourself, if you're fool enough to. Me, I've the rest of the night ahead of me in the cold, tending the ones what's hurt themselves, and lucky if at least one don't die." Swan ground her teeth. The imbecile took her for one of the seamstresses. Or one of the wives. For some reason that seemed worse. She stuck her right fist in front of his face so quickly that he stepped back with a curse, but she shoved her hand close enough to his nose that her great serpent ring had to be the only thing he could see. His eyes crossed, staring at it. "The mildest mount you can find," she said in a flat voice. "But quickly." The ring did the trick. He swallowed, then scratched his head and stared along the horse lines, where every animal seemed to be either stamping or shivering. "Mild," he muttered. I'll see what I can do, Aes Sedai. Mild. Touching a knuckle to his forehead, he hurried off down the rows of horses, still muttering to himself. Swan did a little muttering herself as she paced, three strides this way and three that. Snow trampled to slush and frozen again crunched under her stout shoes. From what she could see, it might take him hours to find anything that would not pitch her off if it heard a grunter jump. Swinging her cloak around her shoulders, she shoved the small silver circle pin in place with an impatient jab, nearly stabbing her own thumb. Afraid, was she? She would show Gareth bloody, bloody Bryn! Back and forth, back and forth. Perhaps she should walk the whole long way. It would be unpleasant, but better than being dumped from the saddle and maybe breaking bones in the bargain. She never mounted a horse, including Bella, without thinking of broken bones. But the fellow returned with a dark mare bearing a high-cantled saddle. "She's mild?" Swan demanded skeptically. The animal was stepping as though ready to dance, and looked sleek. That was supposed to indicate speed.
"Night Lily here's meek as milk water, Aes Sedai. Belongs to my wife, and Amaris is on the delicate side. She don't like a mount what gets frisky."
"If you say so," she replied, and sniffed. Horses were seldom meek in her experience. But there was nothing for it. Taking the reins, she clambered awkwardly into the saddle, then had to shift so she was not sitting on her cloak and half strangling herself every time she moved. The mare did dance, however she sawed the reins. She'd been sure it would, trying to break her bones already. A boat now! With one oar or two, a boat went where you wanted and stopped when you wanted, unless you were a complete fool about tides and currents and winds. But horses possessed brains, however small, and that meant they might take it into their minds to ignore bridle and reins and what the rider wanted. That had to be considered when you had to straddle a bloody horse.
"One thing, Aes Sedai," the man said as she was trying to find a comfortable seat.
Why did saddles always seem harder than wood?
"I'd keep her to a walk tonight, was I you. That wind, you know, and all that stink, well, she might be just a touch..."
"No time," Swan said, and dug her heels in. Mika's milk water Night Lily leaped ahead so fast that she nearly pitched backward over the cantle. Only a quick grab at the pommel kept her in the saddle. She thought the fellow shouted something after her, but she could not be certain. What in the light did this Namaris consider a frisky horse? The mare sped out of the camp as though trying to win a race, sped toward the falling moon and dragon mount, a dark spike rising against the starry sky. Cloak billowing behind, Swan made no effort to slow her, rather digging in her heels again and slapping the mare's neck with the reins as she had seen others do to urge speed. She had to reach the sisters before anybody did something irretrievable. All too many possibilities came to mind. The mare galloped past small thickets and tiny hamlets and sprawling farms with their stone-walled pastures and fields. Snug beneath snow-covered slate roofs, behind walls of stone or brick, the inhabitants had not been roused by that fierce wind. Every building lay dark and still. Even the bloody cows and sheep were probably enjoying a good night's sleep. Farmers always had cows and sheep. And pigs. Bouncing around on the hard leather of the saddle, she tried leaning forward over the mare's neck. That was how it was done. She had seen it. Almost immediately, she lost the left stirrup and nearly slid off on that side, barely clawing her way back to get her foot back in place. The only thing to do was sit bolt upright, one hand clutching the pommel in a death grip, the other tighter still on the reins. Her flailing cloak tugged uncomfortably against her throat, and she jounced up and down so hard that her teeth clicked if she opened her mouth at the wrong time, but she hung on, and even heeled the animal once more. Ah, light, but she was going to be bruised within an inch of her life come sunrise. On through the night, smacking the saddle with the mare's every bounding stride. At least her clenched teeth kept her from yawning. At last the horse lines and rows of wagons that ringed the Aes Sedai camp appeared out of the darkness through a thin rim of trees, and with a sigh of relief she hauled back on the reins as hard as she could. For a horse moving this fast, surely it required hard hauling to stop. Night Lily did stop, so abruptly that she would have hurtled over its head if the mare had not reared at the same time. Wide-eyed, she clung to the animal's neck until it finally settled all four hooves to the ground again, and for some little time after as well. Night Lily was breathing hard, too, she realized. Panting, really. She felt no sympathy. The fool animal had tried to kill her just the way horses would. Recovering herself took a moment, but then she pulled her cloak straight, gathered the reins, and rode past the wagons and the long lines of horses at a sedate walk. Shadowy men moved in the darkness along the horse lines, doubtless grooms and farriers seeing to the visibly unsettled animals. The mare seemed more biddable now. Really, this was not too bad at all. As she entered the camp proper, she hesitated only a moment before embracing Sayadaw. Strange to think of a camp full of Aes Sedai as dangerous, yet two sisters had been murdered here. Considering the circumstances of their deaths, it seemed unlikely that holding the power would be enough to save her if she was the next target, but Sayadaw at least gave an illusion of safety, so long as she remembered it was only illusion. After a moment she wove the flows of spirit that would hide her ability and the glow of the power. There was no need to advertise, after all. Even at this hour, with the moon low in the west, there were a few people out on the wooden walkways, serving women and workmen, scurrying about late tasks. Or perhaps early would be a better word now. Most of the tents, in nearly every size and shape imaginable, were dark, but a number of the larger ones glowed with the light of lamps or candles. Unsurprising under the circumstances. Every lit tent had men around it or gathered in front. Warders. No one else could stand so still they seemed to fade into the night, especially not in this icy night. With the power filling her, she could make out others, their warders' cloaks making them vanish in the shadows. Between the murdered sisters and what their bonds to their Aes Sedai must be carrying to them, not surprising at all. She suspected more than one sister was ready to tear her own hair, or someone else's. They took note of her, heads swiveling to follow her passage as she rode slowly along the frozen ruts, searching. The hall had to be informed, of course, but others needed to hear first. In her estimation, they were much more likely to do something precipitate, and quite possibly disastrous. Oaths held them, but oaths given under duress, to a woman they now believed dead. For the hall, for most of the hall, they had nailed their flag to the mast in accepting a seat. None of them would be jumping until they were very, very sure where they would land. Shiriam's tent was too small for what she was sure she would find, and dark besides, she noted in passing. She very much doubted the woman was asleep inside, though. Morvryn's, big enough to sleep four comfortably, would have done if there was room among all the books the Brown had managed to acquire on the march, but that was dark as well. Her third choice provided a catch, though, and she reined in Night Lily well short of it. Mirel had two peaked tents in the camp, one for herself and one for her three warders, the three she dared acknowledge, and her own shone brightly, the shadows of women moving on the patched canvas walls. Three dissimilar men stood on the walkway in front of the tent. Their stillness marked them warders, but she ignored them for the moment. What exactly were they talking about inside? Certain that it was useless effort, she wove air with just a hint of fire. Her weave touched the tent and struck a barrier against eavesdropping. Inverted, of course, and so invisible to her. She had only made the attempt on the chance they were being careless. Small possibility of that with the secrets they had to hide. The shadows against the canvas were still now, so they knew someone had tried. She rode the rest of the way, wondering what they had been talking about. As she dismounted, well, at least she managed to turn half falling off into something akin to jumping down, one of the warders, Shiriam's Arinvar, a lean Kyrianin little taller than she, stepped forward to reach for the reins with a small bow, but she waved him away. Releasing Sayadaw, she tied the mare to one of the wooden slats of the walkway, using a knot that would have held a sizable boat against heavy winds and a strong current. None of those casual loops that others used, not for her. She might dislike riding, but when she tied a horse, she wanted it there when she came back. Arinvar's eyebrows climbed as he watched her finish the knot, but he would not be the one who had to pay for the bloody animal if it got loose and lost itself. Only one of the other two warders belonged to Mirel,
Avar Hachami, a Saldaean with a nose like an eagle's beak and thick gray-streaked mustaches. After sparing her one glance and a slight inclination of his head, he returned to watching the night. Morvryn's jury, short and bald and nearly as wide as he was tall, did not acknowledge her at all. His eyes studied the darkness, and his hand rested lightly on his long sword hilt. Supposedly he was among the best of the warders with a blade. Where were the others? She could not ask, of course, any more than she could ask who was within. The men would have been shocked to their bones. None of them tried to stop her from entering. At least matters had not gotten that bad. Inside, where two braziers gave off the scent of roses and made the air almost toasty compared to the night, she found almost everyone she had hoped for, and all watching to see who entered. Mirel herself, sitting on a sturdy straight chair in a silk robe covered with red and yellow flowers, her arms folded beneath her breasts, wore such a perfect expression of calm on her olive face that it only pointed up the heat in her dark eyes. The light of the power shone around her. It was her tent, after all. She would be the one to weave a ward here. Shiriam, seated on one end of Mirel's cot with a straight back, pretended to be adjusting her blue-slashed skirts. Her expression was as fiery as her hair, and it grew hotter when she saw Swan. She was not wearing the Keeper's stole, a bad sign. "I might have expected it would be you," Carlenia said coldly, fists on her hips. She was never a warm woman, but now the ringlets that stopped well short of her shoulders framed a face that seemed carved from ice nearly as pale as her dress. "I will not have you trying to listen in on my private conversations, Swan." Oh, yes. They thought everything was at an end. Round-faced Morvryn, for once not appearing at all absent-minded or sleepy-eyed, despite the creases in her brown wool skirt, walked around the small table where a tall silver pitcher and five silver cups sat on a lacquered tray. It seemed no one felt like tea. The cups were all dry. Dipping into her belt pouch, the graying sister thrust a carven horn comb into Swan's hand. "You are all wind-blown, woman. Fix your hair before some lout takes you for a tavern trull instead of an Aes Sedai and tries to dandle you on his knee." "Egwene and Lyanna are alive and prisoners inside the tower," Swan announced, more calmly than she felt. "A tavern trull?" Touching her hair, she discovered that the other woman was right, and began working the comb through the tangles. If you wanted to be taken seriously, you could not look as though you had been tussling in an alley. She had enough difficulty with that as it was now, and would have until some years after she could lay hands on the oath rod again. "Egwene spoke to me in my dreams. They succeeded in blocking the harbors near enough, but they were captured. Where are Baenin and Nisau? One of you go fetch them. I don't want to scale the same fish twice." There. If they thought themselves free of their oaths and free of Egwene's orders to obey her, that should disabuse them. Except that no one moved to obey. "Baenin wanted her bed," Morvryn said slowly, studying Swan. A very intense study. A sharp mind hid behind that placid face. "She was too tired to talk any more. And why would we have asked Nisau to join us?" That earned a small frown from Mirel, who was Nisau's friend, but the other two nodded agreement. They and Baenin thought of Nisau as apart from themselves, in spite of the oaths of fealty they shared. In Swan's opinion, these women had never stopped believing they might still guide events somehow, even after the rudder had long since been taken from their hands. Shiriam rose from the cot as though about to rush off, even gathering her skirts, but that had nothing to do with Swan's command. Anger had vanished, replaced by shining eagerness. "We don't need them for the moment in any case. Prisoners means the deep cells until the hall convenes for a trial. We can travel there and free them before Elida knows what is happening." Mirel gave a sharp nod and stood, reaching to undo the sash of her robe. "Best if we leave the warders behind, I think. They won't be needed in this." She drew more deeply on the source, already anticipating. "No," Swan said sharply, and winced as the comb caught in her hair. Sometimes she thought of cutting it shorter than Carlinia's, for convenience, but Gareth had complimented her, saying how much he liked the way it brushed her shoulders. Light! Could she not escape the man even here? Egwene isn't to be tried, and she isn't in the deep cells. She wouldn't tell me where she is being held except to say that she is guarded constantly, and she orders that there be no attempt to rescue her that involves sisters. The other women stared at her in shocked silence. In truth, she herself had argued the point with Egwene, to no avail. It had been an order, delivered by the Armorlin seat in full fig.
"What you're saying is irrational," Carlinia said finally.
Her tone was still cool, her face serene, but her hands smoothed her embroidered white skirts unnecessarily.
"If we capture Elida, we will try her and very likely still her."
"If?" Their doubts and fears were not put to rest yet.
"Since she has Egwene, surely she will do the same. I don't need Bayonin to tell me what the law says in that regard."
"We must rescue her, whatever she wants!" Shiriam's voice was hot as Carlinia's was chill, and her green eyes sparkled. Her hands had turned to fists, gripping her skirts. "She cannot realize the danger she is in. She must be in shock. Did she give you any hints where she's held?"
"Don't try to hide things from us, Swan," Mirel said firmly.
Her eyes seemed almost on fire, and she jerked the silk sash tighter for emphasis.
"Why would she hide where she's being held?"
"For fear of what you and Shiriam suggest." Giving up on the wind-whipped tangles, Swan tossed the comb down on the table. She could not stand there combing her hair and expect them to pay attention. Tousled would have to do. "She is guarded, Mirel, by sisters, and they won't give her up easily. If we try a rescue, Aes Sedai will die at the hands of Aes Sedai, sure as silver pike spawn in the reeds. It's happened once, but it must not happen again, or all hope dies of reuniting the tower peacefully. We cannot allow it to happen again. So there is to be no rescue. As to why Elida has decided not to try her, I can't say."
Egwene had been vague on that, as if she did not understand either. But she had been definite on the facts, and it was not a claim she would make unless she was sure.
"Peacefully," Shiriam muttered, sinking back onto the cot. She imbued the word with a world of bitterness. "Was there ever any chance of that from the beginning? Elida has abolished the Blue Aja. What chance of peace is there?"
"Elida cannot simply do away with an Aja," Morvryn murmured, as though that had anything to do with anything.
She patted Shiriam's shoulder, but the fire-haired woman sullenly shrugged off her plump hand.
"There is always a chance," Carlinia said. "The harbors are blocked, strengthening our position. The negotiators meet every morning."
Trailing off with a troubled look in her eyes, she poured a cup of tea and drank half of it down in one go without adding honey. Blocking the harbors likely would have put an end to the negotiations by itself, not that they had seemed to be going anywhere. Would Elida let them continue, with Egwene in her hands, besides?
"I do not comprehend why Elida would not have Egwene put on trial," Morvryn said, "since conviction would be sure and certain. But the fact remains that she is a prisoner."
She displayed none of Shiriam or Mirel's heat, and none of Carlinia's coldness. She was simply presenting the facts, with only a slight tightness of her mouth.
"If she is not to be tried, then without any doubt she is to be broken. She has proven to be a stronger woman than I took her for at first, but no one is strong enough to resist the White Tower when it decides to break her. We must consider the consequences if we don't get her out before it can."
Swan shook her head. "She isn't even going to be birched, Morvryn. I don't understand why either, but she'd hardly tell us to leave her if she thought they were going to torture—" She broke off as the tent flap was pushed open, and Lelaine Akashi stepped in, blue-fringed shawl draped along her arms. Shiriam stood, though she need not have. Lelaine was a sitter, but Shiriam was the keeper. Then again Lelaine was imposing in blue-slashed velvet despite her slenderness, dignity made flesh, with an air of authority that seemed greater than ever tonight. Every hair in place, she might have been entering the hall after a sound night's sleep. Smoothly, Swan turned to the table and picked up the pitcher as if in anticipation. That normally would have been her role in this company, to pour tea and speak when her opinion was sought. Perhaps if she remained quiet, Lelaine would be about her business with the others and leave quickly without giving her a second glance.
The woman seldom did give her that much.
"I thought that horse outside was the same I saw you ride in on, Swan."
Lelaine's gaze ran over the other sisters, each of them absolutely smooth-faced now.
"Am I interrupting?"
"Swan says Egwene is alive," Shiriam said, as though relating the price of Delta perch on the dockhead.
"And Lyanna. Egwene spoke to Swan's dreams. She refuses any attempt at a rescue."
Mirel gave her a sidelong glance, unreadable, but Swan could have boxed her ears. Likely Lelaine would have been the next she sought out, but to tell her in her own way, not spilled out on the wharf like this? Of late, Shiriam had become as flighty as a novice.
Pursing her lips, Lelaine directed a look like twin awls at Swan.
"Did she know? You really should be wearing your stole, Shiriam. You are the keeper. Will you walk with me, Swan? It's been far too long since we had a conversation alone."
With one hand, she drew back the door flap, shifting that penetrating gaze to the other sisters. Shiriam blushed as only a redhead could, brilliantly, and fumbled the narrow blue stole from her belt pouch to lay it across her shoulders. But Mirel and Carlinia met Lelaine's study with level eyes. Morvern had begun tapping her round chin with a fingertip as though unaware of anyone else. She might well have been. Morvern was like that.
Had Egwene's orders sunk in? Swan had no chance even for a firm look while putting the pitcher down. A suggestion from a sister of Lelaine's standing, sitter or not, was a command to one of Swan's standing. Gathering her cloak and skirts, she went out, murmuring thanks to Lelaine for holding the flap for her. Light she hoped those fools had listened to what she said.
Four warders stood outside now, but one of them was Lelaine's Barin, a copper-skinned stump of a Damani wrapped in a warder cloak that made most of him seem not there. And Eivor had been replaced by another of Mirel's, Nuhel Dromond, a tall, burly man with an Ilianer beard that left his upper lip bare. The man was so still you might have thought him a statue if not for the wisps of mist in front of his nostrils. Arinvar bowed to Lelaine, a quick courtesy, though formal. Nuhel and Jori did not let their vigilance slacken, nor did Barin, for that matter. The knot that secured Nightlily took as long to undo as it had to tie, but Lelaine waited patiently until Swan straightened with the reins in her hands, then set off at a slow pace along the wooden walkway past dark tents. Moon shadows masked her face. She did not embrace the power, so Swan could not either. Trailed by Barin, Swan walked beside Lelaine, leading the mare, holding her silence. It was the sitter's place to begin, and not only because she was a sitter. Swan fought the urge to bend her neck and so lose the extra inch she had on the other woman. She seldom thought any longer of the time when she had been Amarlin. She had been embraced as Aes Sedai once more, and part of being Aes Sedai meant fitting into your niche among the sisters instinctively. The bloody horse nuzzled at her hand as though it thought itself a pet, and she shifted the reins to her other hand long enough to wipe her fingers on her cloak. Filthy, slobbering beast. Lelaine eyed her sideways, and she felt her cheeks heating. Instinct.
"Strange friends you have, Swan. I believe some of them were in favor of sending you away when you first appeared in Saladar. Shiriam I might comprehend, though I'd think the fact that she stands so much higher than you now would make for awkwardness. That was the major reason I avoided you myself. To avoid awkwardness."
Swan nearly gaped in astonishment. That came very near to talking about what was never to be talked about. Very near. A transgression she would never have expected from this woman. From herself, perhaps. She had fitted herself into her niche, yet she was who she was. But never from Lelaine.
"I hope you and I can become friends again, Swan. Though I can understand if that proves impossible. This meeting tonight confirms what Faelaine told me."
Lelaine gave a small laugh and folded her hands at her waist.
"Oh, don't grimace so, Swan. She didn't betray you, at least not intentionally. She made one slip too many, and I decided to press her, rather hard. Not the way to treat another sister, but then she's really just an accepted until she can be tested and passes. Faelaine will make a fine Aes Sedai.
She was very reluctant to surrender everything she gave. Just bits and pieces, really, and a few names. But put together with you in that gathering, it gives me a complete picture, I think. I suppose I can let her free of confinement now. She certainly won't think of spying on me again. You and your friends have been very faithful to Egwene, Swan. Can you be as faithful to me? So that was why Faelaine had seemed to go into hiding. How many bits and pieces had she revealed while being pressed hard? Faelaine did not know everything, yet it would be best to assume that Lelaine did. But assume while revealing nothing unless she herself was pressed hard. Swan stopped dead, drawing herself up. Lelaine halted too, clearly waiting for her to speak. Even with her face half in shadow, that was clear. Swan had to steel herself to confront this woman. Some instincts were buried in the bone for Aes Sedai. I'm faithful to you as a sitter for my Aja, but Egwene Al'Vir is the Ammerlin's seat. So she is. Lelaine's expression remained unruffled, as much as Swan could make out. She spoke in your dreams? Tell me what you know of her situation, Swan. Swan glanced over her shoulder at the stocky warder. Don't mind him, the sitter said. I haven't kept a secret from Beryn in 20 years. In my dreams, Swan agreed. She certainly did not intend to admit that had been only to summon her to Saladar in Telairan Riod. She was not supposed to have that ring in her possession. The Hall would take it away if they learned of it. Calmly, outwardly calmly at least, she related what she had told Mirel and the others, and more. But not everything. Not the certainty of betrayal. That had to have come from the Hall itself. No one else had known of the plan to block the harbor except the women involved, though whoever was accountable could not have known they were betraying Egwene, only helping Elida, which was mystery enough. Why would any among them want to help Elida? There had been talk of Elida's secret adherence from the start, yet she herself had long since dismissed the notion. Most assuredly, every Blue fervently wanted Elida pulled down, but until she knew who was responsible, no sitter, not even a Blue, would learn everything. She's calling a sitting of the Hall for tomorrow. No, it would be tonight, now, when last sounds, she finished. Inside the tower, in the Hall of the Tower. Lelaine laughed so hard that she had to brush a tear from her eye. Oh, that is priceless! The Hall to sit right under Elida's nose, as it were. I almost wish I could let her know, just to see her face. Just as abruptly, she turned serious again. Lelaine had always had a ready laugh when she chose to let it out, but the core of her was always serious. So Egwene thinks the Ajahs may be turning on one another. That hardly seems possible. She's only seen a handful of sisters, you say. Still, it bears looking into the next time in Telairan Riod. Perhaps someone can see what they can find in the Aja quarters instead of concentrating on Elida's study. Swan barely suppressed a wince. She planned to do a little searching in Telairan Riod herself. Whenever she went to the tower in the world of dreams, she was a different woman in a different dress every time she turned a corner, but she would have to be even more cautious than usual. Refusing rescue is understandable, I suppose, even laudable. No one wants any more dead sisters. But very risky, Lelaine went on. No trial and not even a birching? What can Elida be playing at? Can she think to make her take up as accepted again? That hardly seems likely. But she gave a small nod, as though considering it. This was heading in a dangerous direction. If sisters convinced themselves they knew where Egwene might be, the chance increased that someone would try to bring her out, Aes Sedai guards or no. Trying at the wrong place could be as risky as at the right one, if not more so. Worse, Lelaine was ignoring something. Egwene has called the Hall to sit, Swan asked acidly. Will you go? Reproving silence answered her, and her cheeks grew hot again. Some things were buried in the bone. Of course I will go, Lelaine said at last. A direct statement, yet there had been a pause. The entire Hall will go.
Egwene Alvir is the Ammerlin seat, and we have more than sufficient dream Tirangrial. Perhaps she will explain how she believes she can hold out if Elida orders her broken. I would very much like to hear that.
Then what are you asking me to be faithful to you about?
Instead of answering, Lelaine resumed her slow walk through the moonlight, carefully adjusting her shawl. Beryn followed her, a half-invisible lion in the night. Swan hurried to catch up, tugging Night Lily after her, fending off the fool mare's attempts to nuzzle her hand again.
Egwene Alvir is the lawful Ammerlin seat, Lelaine said finally. Until she dies, or is stilled.
Should either happen, we would be back to Romanda trying for the staff and the stole, and me forestalling her, she snorted. That woman would be a disaster as bad as Elida. Unfortunately, she had enough support to forestall me as well. We'd be back to that, except that if Egwene dies or is stilled, you and your friends will be as faithful to me as you've been to Egwene, and you will help me gain the Ammerlin seat in spite of Romanda.
Swan felt as though her stomach had turned to ice. No blue would have been behind the first betrayal, but one blue, at least, had reason to betray Egwene now.